Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with jazz musician, composer, bandleader, and educator Daryl Kotz. He talked about his 2022 CD, the new Odd Songs CD called Galeanthropology. The album features original songs, pop classics, and jazz standards with four saxophones, a violin, a marimba, and voice. It goes from Jimi Hendrix's Belly Button Window to original jazz art song settings set to his late wife, Paula. Originally, he's from Topeka, Kansas, and he's lived in the Boston area since 1975. We originally interviewed back in 2018, and these days things are vastly different, but we had a great talk about it all. Enjoy.
Let's talk a little bit about the brand new album and Odd Song, and I'm curious. You know, it's coming out during a time where the world's waking up. It's a totally different time on Earth. Talk to me a little bit about what this album means for you.
First of all, yeah, it's a very strange time. Actually, the album came out in October, November, now I can't remember. Yeah, it's been a strange time to be doing that for sure. What does the album mean to me? Well, I don't know. All of the recordings I've ever done are like my children, you know. This one was a continuation of that group, which has been on, you know, COVID has kind of derailed the band, and I've got a performance date in the fall and I want to get it back going again. The music represented a lot of different sides of me, you know, like I mix things together that many people wouldn't stylistically. You know, there's really free, totally improvised music alongside of songs that are really straight ahead, and this doesn't bother me any, you know, they're different things that I'm interested in. So.
You know, during this time of COVID, we've had a lot of time of self-reflection, and I'm curious, what did you learn about yourself over this time that maybe you didn't realize before that will make you stronger as you get out and promote this new album?
That's a very strange question. I learned that I can exist sitting by myself a lot better than I thought I could, because especially in the first year of it, I was just... You know, I really took it all to heart. I was totally isolated. And I can do that. I wasn't quite sure that I could, but I can really be a hermit, I guess. And I learned that it's really difficult to write music when you don't know when it will be played or who will play it. Because initially during COVID, I thought, wow, I'm going to have a lot of time on my hands that I could be really productive. And I was a little bit productive, but it didn't really work that way because the frustration, when will I be able to have this performed? Who's going to play it? Was really hung me up. We started to book gigs for the TCA Orchestra a few times, and each time that some new wave or something came along, and we backed out because we figured having 20 people playing wind instruments crammed together in a tiny little space just wasn't a good idea, and even though some people were doing it. I don't know. I've learned a lot about the world during this pandemic, but not so much about myself and music.
The songs are based off your late wife's poems, and, you know, it kind of, there's a range of music styles that go into this. So ultimately, what do you want the listener to get from this experience? What are you hoping for?
I just hope they enjoy it, maybe are moved by it. And the songs aren't just for my wife's poetry. Most of my original material is. But there's one that I wrote lyrics to. And occasionally I have used other sources. Lately, really, in the past few years, I have been writing lyrics, which I never used to do ever. It takes me a long time, but I'm really happy with the ones that I've written. The one on the album is Galeanthropology. They're mixed in with, you know, songs like Dirty Water, you know, which is, and Sweet Baby James, which are far from each other and far from what we usually do. But I like good songs. Well, Dirty Water came about in an odd way. Got a gig for part of Odd Song at... There was a concert in Boston called, put on by the Celebrity Series of Boston, which is a big institution in Boston. They do things with major orchestras and big stars. And they put on a concert stretched out along the Charles River in Boston, along the Esplanade. They had 25 groups playing at once, hopefully spaced far enough and amplified low enough that they didn't interfere with each other, which did work. And they provided us all with a list of songs, two sets worth of songs, that were either about Boston or in some way connected to Boston. Some of the connections were sort of vague. And in the midst of this, you could include in each set one of your own pieces. So I never would have arranged Dirty Water by the Standells, except that was handed to me by that project. And I liked how it came out, so we recorded it. Sweet Baby James, that's a song that I think is really a wonderful song. And that also originally came from that, but I revised it afterwards considerably. And so I was really particularly happy to do that, because I'd always thought I'd like to arrange a James Taylor song sometime. And I'd never really found the, I don't know, if you're taking on somebody else's music, I have to have some kind of idea of what I want to do with it that is true to the music and still that has me in it. And but that song, I never was getting anywhere until I really needed it for a performance. So I'm not sure all of that was an answer to your question.
Yeah. No, it totally was. Yeah. So let's go back into the beginnings of your life. Talk to me about how kind of the jaws of jazz, so to speak, got in you and how this journey started.
Early on in my life, when I was in the third grade, let's keep in mind, I'm 71 now. I took up playing clarinet. And I played in the school bands, and my dad listened to jazz a lot. And what grabbed my attention at the time was the Dukes of Dixieland, which really have not remained something that I care for. And I feel like, why do I want to hear a bunch of guys imitating music that came 30 or 40 years before them? I really don't. But when I was in third grade, I did. I thought it was great. When I was in about sixth grade, I took up listening to top 40 music on the radio. I mean, I can still remember what some of the hits were in whatever year that was. A few years later, I got an electric guitar and took up rock and roll, and I quit playing the clarinet in the school bands, a move I kind of regret. I wish I would have just continued with that my whole life, but didn't. Kind of rejected everything that my father listened to. Which was, I left out an important thing. My father listened to a lot of jazz, and so my father liked it, I didn't. He listened to a lot of classical music. If he liked it, I didn't. That was a phase. But before that, more important than the Dukes of Dixieland was he used to take me to jazz concerts in Topeka, Kansas, the Topeka Jazz Workshop, which was a big band, you know, little big band. And in fact, I can still remember some of the songs they played. And I think that really made a big impact on me. And who knew that many years later, I would become arranger and composer for big bands. So I think that was really an important factor. So for a long time, I was into rock music of the 60s. And then I discovered blues, like probably about 1968. When I really started getting into blues. In 1969, I went to the Ann Arbor Blues Festival. I also went there in 1970 and heard every blues guy on the planet. You know, there were still a ton of these blues musicians in Chicago. Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Otis Rush, B.B. King, Freddie King, Albert King, Sun House was at these concerts, Magic Sam, Fred McDowell, Lightning Hopkins, just on and on. It was incredible. That was a really life-altering experience. So I was, for a while, I was just totally devoted to blues, rhythm and blues. I was also really into the, kind of, I think it was a golden age of R&B, you know, Aretha Franklin, James Brown, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, Sam and Dave. All that music was really wonderful for me. And I got into a band that everybody else was into that, too. That's where we tried to play. That was in Lawrence, Kansas. And we played, you know, like really a lot for a couple of years. You know, we toured and played regularly. It was a lot of fun. Towards the end of that, I just started to listen to jazz a little bit. And towards the end of that, we actually started playing some standards and bebop tunes, which I couldn't really play. And then, so I decided to go to music school. And when I got there, I discovered something that I've never had any interest in or at all. It never occurred to me composing music. And that became what I was into. Leading up to that, there was a huge range of stylistic things that I went through. The first jazz I got, I'd had a few jazz records all along, kind of an odd collection of them, like four or five albums. And then somewhere in the 70s, I discovered Benny Goodman. I was crazy about that for a while, and soon I was listening to the whole big band era. And weirdly, the last thing I got to was Duke Ellington, which is out of the music that I've ever listened to that has meant the most to me. I've really become a Duke Ellington fanatic, and music of Duke's that I've listened to for 40 years, I still hear new things in it every time. You know, I think he's like not the greatest American artist of anything, you know, painters, playwrights, novelists, sculptors, whatever. Duke Ellington is America's giant. You know, I've been just vastly interested in a lot of other music. Those early things, you know, all that blues and Duke Ellington are just kind of the bedrock. Like the inspiration, originally Odd Song came out of, I started a sax quartet, and I was inspired by the World Sax Quartet. I just loved the World Sax Quartet, and I thought, I want to write for sax quartets, and so I did. Usually to start one, you have to play a saxophone, which I didn't, but I started it anyway. And years later, expanded it into Odd Song. Speaking of the World Sax Quartet, one of the great things the JCA Orchestra did was have, for a while, we had a lot of great guest artists, and we had Julius Hemphill several times, and he's on two of our albums, and we had Oliver Lake. In fact, he's also on one of them in a live performance. So, and playing with people like that is always just exciting and amazing.
The one thing I wanted to kind of touch on, too, before we departed, what's going on in this modern day and era. I mean, we haven't had a lot of time to do live music in the last 2 years. We've largely been away from it. What do you hope we all realize about the power of live music as we get back to it?
Do we hope we all realize what a valuable and wonderful thing it is? I've watched a lot of streaming music, and it's just mostly it's just not the same. Although there is one streaming music I've watched a lot of. Are you familiar with Emmett Cohen?
Oh yeah,
yeah. I've watched really a lot of those. Those guys are incredible.
Yeah.
They're mostly just playing standards, which is something I'm usually not, you know, interested in hearing the standards over, but they're just fantastic. There's nothing compared to live music, and the few things I've been starting to get out to, night and day, you know, there's nothing like being there. As a composer, for me, you know, it's nice to make recordings, but the best thing is performing them, and that's all there is to it. It's nothing else like it.
So, you know, as an educator, as somebody that's been close to the jazz craft for as long as you have, this has been a pretty big jolt, you know, to go through this time of no live music and just in general for the performing arts, especially jazz. How do you see the recovery and getting back to it happening? I mean, do you see that this is going to sway younger people from not getting into jazz or make them stronger that they're in it? How do you see things kind of redeveloping and getting back to a stronger place?
I honestly don't know what's going to happen. There's in Boston, there's just, well, everywhere, I think, there's just less and less places to perform jazz, and particularly the kind that my groups do. I don't know what's going to happen. You know, the world really got impacted by, well, just the world of music got really impacted by everything being shut down, and I really wonder what's going to happen. I certainly can't tell you. A lot of the places in Boston that I thought might cease to exist are still around, but some are gone. In Boston, there's been less and less clubs over the years anyway, and there's what's replaced them, not replaced them, but what has come along since are a small number of performance spaces, you know, that aren't really clubs. And they've become active again. I've only been to any of them a few times. I know it's very puzzling as far as the educational end of it. I really, it really was sad see, but I assume how it probably affected our students who went from being in an environment. Part of the experience of going to my school, Berkeley, is, you know, the classroom part is really important and the private lessons are really important, but the environment, being there, and, you know, that's really a big thing, playing music a lot, hearing other people play music a lot, all that went away. And I felt really awful for our students who their almost entire education for a year or more was on Zoom. This isn't the same. I'm teaching classroom lecture kind of things. It is feasible to do that way. It's been much better being back in the classroom, but, you know, ensembles and things like that, it's just, and they tried to do things, you know, they'd have people record their part to music and they'd put it all together. But yeah, I felt terrible for the students missing out on that for over a year. And it's still limited. So.
Well, fingers crossed. I know the last time that we spoke was back in 2018 when things were much, much different. So hopefully we can catch up again in the future when things are hopefully better. But I appreciate you talking about the new album and kind of what's been going on lately. I appreciate it.
2018 was a different time for sure.
Yeah, it's really weird to talk to musicians that I spoke to before COVID, because it was just everything. There's just no way that you can put words on what's happened. I mean, COVID has been one component, but there's also, you know, everything with Ukraine and our political system, and everything's just kind of gone haywire.
Don't even get me started on all the various issues confronting us. We have three things booked in the fall, and so we'll be back.
At least we have the music. I think that's the key to all of this. The music has been one of the saving graces for times like this, and it's been a huge healer for a lot of people, I think.
In the last few months, I've been writing music a lot again, so it's worked out.
Absolutely.
I, like I said, COVID just really prevented me from getting very ambitious, but I've returned to where I can get lost on the pages.
That's wonderful. Well, Daryl, thank you. I appreciate your time. Good luck with the new album and the return to the stage. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview. We give you a bit of insight into the finest players and minds in Topeka, Boston, Kansas City, and spots all over the globe, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Daryl for his time, music, and stories. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com. And for everything Neon Jazz, go to the NeonJazz.blogspot.com. And finally, for everything Joe Domino related, go to JoeDomino.com, and if you feel like it, you can kick in a few bucks to the Neon Jazz cause. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.